Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and this week we'll be talking about blockchain getting into the consumer space, Flipkart gets into the financial services game, and Nubank gets a big investment in money and strategy from Tencent. Also, Islamic finance getting some help from FinTech, and robo-advisors finally take a bite into financial advisory fees. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in FinTech news. What is the thing you cook with in Morocco, Moroccan food?
Like
I can't think of the name right now.
Tagine?
Tagine. Oh, I love tagines.
I think that's the dish, not the actual pot.
Oh, no, it's both. It's like saying casserole.
Oh, okay, cool. Huh,
cazuela? Do you make
cazuela? I don't make cazuela. No.
The Latin cazuela? Hi, so Monica won't be with us this week. She's on assignment in Morocco, but we'll be back with us soon. But we still have Steve with us this week.
I'm a consolation prize, but yeah, she'll be back when she's done with her FinTech newscast assignment in beautiful North Africa.
Yeah, great. Yeah, well, we could never fill in, but...
We can do our best.
We can do our best, yeah. All right, so let's get started with blockchain in the consumer space. Now, this is best represented lately with CryptoKitties. So, do you know the highest amount that someone has paid for a CryptoKitty?
Enlighten me.
It's a crazy amount. So, this is a virtual cat that you custom design on the Ethereum blockchain. So, they're essentially free to make, I guess, more or less. And but someone paid over $110,000.
For a crypto...
For a virtual cat.
Is this basically a blockchain-powered Tamagotchi?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, that's what it looks like. So hopefully he didn't let it starve or something like that. You'd be out a bit. But this is one of the early applications of Ethereum in the consumer space. Now, the average price of a CryptoKitty is only $25, so not too crazy.
So I'm more reasonable.
Yeah, but you know, still a lot for something that's that doesn't exist anywhere, that's completely virtual to play with. It's not functional.
Useless. Yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah. But people have exchanged about $6.7 million on CryptoKitty so far.
So is it an issue of sort of like in the online games where you can spend time mining the coins to build a better kitty and then you can sell that off to somebody else who maybe lacks the time?
Well, there's always a transaction fee. Yeah, yeah. I think it's more like someone taking the time to do it. Like kind of like a, I think of it as like the video game.
Sure.
Where you can just.
You mine the whatever diamonds or whatever thing is.
Yeah, you can do it by playing for 10 hours or you can spend $5 and just get the next power
from
up
like
or
a
whatever.
Chinese farm or something. Like a Chinese.
From, yeah. It's a great model for the gaming companies. And so actually they're the most distributed applications on Ethereum. 42% of them are gaming. So. You know, something, it's kind of a consumer-y thing. And what this particular article is talking about, it's called Beyond CryptoKitties, Is There a Place for Blockchain in the B2C Market? And getting people comfortable with using blockchain-powered applications in their day-to-day life and normal things. Now, everybody that works with blockchain kind of knows it's a back-end kind of thing. It works on, it helps for security, privacy, those types of applications, and maybe the consumer wouldn't even know that they're using something that's being blockchain powered, because the front end should be just simple and friendly, and you wouldn't know. And an example of that is in the largest crypto market is in South Korea, and in a survey done by Bitcoin.com, 90% of the people have heard of Bitcoin and more or less understood what it is, but only 8% knew what a blockchain was and understood what it does, how it's related to cryptocurrencies. So that's another step along the way of getting a wider acceptance of blockchain, and not just Bitcoin, but proprietary blockchains run by large companies, you know, as well as the public ones that we all know about.
So this is basically saying that because of the popularity of CryptoKitties, we now may have people who know how the tech works and know the concept behind it as well, but also engage in it on a maybe daily basis so they can build their little kitties or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. So one step, CryptoKitties are one little kitty step along the path of blockchain getting full distribution out into the consumer world. There's some apps that are trying to do that. There's one called, and there's a lot of projects. I mean, I think the problem is a lot of these are being tested, and they haven't gotten released. You know, we're permanently in the proof of concept stage.
Right.
One of these is called Golem. It's built on Ethereum, and it's meant to share computer processing power across hundreds or thousands of different machines. And you know, they would pay you a small amount of token for their use of that, and they can sell that. So they're kind of like the intermediary, a secure intermediary.
Using computer.
And there's lots of these interesting projects like that, but they just haven't gotten out there. In this case, and many others, they're kind of very tech oriented and focused. I mean, you wouldn't use this, unless you were a large application, or had to set up the Golem software on your computer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not quite there yet in terms of the front end that makes it simple for you. But they're building on it. So a few more steps to go. But hopefully we'll see a lot more besides crypto kitties and virtual lotteries and that sort of thing. All right. Next up is we're going to take a trip over to India and Flipkart.
Let's go to India. Absolutely. So there's an article in entrepreneur.com that details why Flipkart is apparently keen to enter the financial services sector. So Flipkart, as you may know, is the India-based, I'm going to call it Amazon and Postmates all into one. You can basically order
shopping and delivery.
You can shop. You can order your deliveries. You can order groceries. You can do some courier stuff as well. But so Flipkart is one of the biggest private companies, tech companies rather, in India. So according to this article from entrepreneur.com, Flipkart is looking to apply for its non-banking financial company license, which will give it the ability to offer financial service products in India.
That's such a great synergy for them because they're lending money to people so that they can buy more on their own site.
It is. I think it's a smart play also because they're looking to build out their ecosystems, which is something that we've seen in China. So, for example, in China, we know that Alibaba began as this Amazon-like online marketplace, and now they've eventually spun off things like Ant Financial, and now they're getting into brokerage. So basically, they see it as a way to get people to get onto their platform to buy and sell goods. And now it looks like Flipkart may also offer the ability for small and medium enterprises to also sell their stuff on credit. So now they can get credit on the stuff they're selling. They can get maybe some payment services. So it's a very smart play that we've seen replicated across Asia as well. So again, with Alibaba now getting into Ant Financial, getting into brokerage and wealth management and other services, we see it in Korea with KakaoTalk, sort of the Korean WhatsApp clone, now also getting potentially a banking license in Korea as well. So they can also do micropayments or P2P payments and stuff.
And Alibaba's invested in them, I think.
They have as well. Alibaba has gone on this tear recently where they've...
On the South Korean one.
On the South Korean one, and also I think across Asia, Thailand, and Hong Kong, where they've basically invested in all these companies and they can do things like e-commerce or retail. Any kind of experience that relies on users using their mobile phones to conduct a transaction, Alibaba is interested in seeing whether they can insert themselves in that as well, so they can be so they can provide the rails through which the payments will go on.
So Flipkart wants to follow in their footsteps. It seems like a natural connection.
It seems like a very smart play, yeah. And just in terms of some context here, we know of course that India's economy is heavily reliant on the informal sector. And according to this article here, they have, you know, there's about $650 billion in opportunity for small and medium enterprises that don't have financing or any kind of banking right now. So Flipkart, which is pretty popular now, can now offer other payment services. This could be a great way for them to kind of grow their user base.
Yeah, I've seen this as a big gap in a lot of countries where small and medium businesses, even down to individuals, could grow so much more. It would be a big boost for their economies. And places like Kiva and microlenders have attacked that. But there still seems to be a gap, a need for that kind of financing to grow these smaller businesses.
It's a huge play, yeah. And it's also the author here of the article is also very clear in saying that this could be seen as a potential copycat solution to what Alibaba is doing in China. But it's just the right play. It's how you build your ecosystem, how you go from selling stuff to financing the sale of stuff and goods. That's how companies grow.
Well, you know, Flipkart is so dominant in India, apparently. Are there other competitors that can break it up, or is there some worry that companies like Flipkart and Alibaba and the equivalents in other countries become like semi-monopolies across a couple of different industries?
I know the Chinese government in China at least has tried to rein in some of the stuff that Alibaba can do with payment stuff. So this could be the case with Flipkart, but because this is Flipkart's very first entry into the payment slash financing space, I don't foresee a lot of regulatory pushback, but it could definitely be the case.
It's kind of like some of those dystopian tales. You live in a Flipkart house, you rent a Flipkart car, you work in a Flipkart factory, and you know they just and maybe not the physical version of that, but the digital and your private information version of seeing everything, every piece of your life like that.
Yeah, which I think is what all of the US-based companies are doing. Like Facebook wants you to now how it
Well,
do.
there's a lot of value. Yeah, I
There's a
guess I
great
could see
value in that.
that.
Yeah, if they can lock you into that ecosystem, absolutely. If you can now make video conference calls via Facebook, if you can have
And they
an
have a
Alexa
record of everything you
and
do,
have a
your
record of
payments, where
that.
you like to shop, how you talk to.
Absolutely, they can track your location. So this is kind of just the next step, I think, the next step in the evolution of startups as all-encompassing sort of ecosystem plays.
Sure. Well, Flipkart sounds like they're just starting along that path. They're a little bit behind the other companies, but they're big enough to invest and build it, I guess.
They are, yeah. And actually, on a related article, I saw recently that Tencent, the tea and the Chinese bats company, right, just invested $180 million in a Brazilian neobank called Nubank.
And they're doing the same thing. They're doing small loans and payments, but they're not a market. They're just doing the financial side.
They're doing the financial side, yeah. So basically, they offer fee-free credit cards and digital payment accounts in Brazil, which again is a very underserved market. So I think
Undeserved?
underserved
Are you saying they don't
market.
deserve?
They do deserve cool tech solutions. They're just underserved.
Right. Yeah, I saw with this investment, Nubank is now valued at $4 billion. So,
Which I think may be the highest valued fintech startup in Brazil.
Tencent has investments all over the world. It seems like they're going to have these connections all over the third world. They've invested in the Philippines, as far as Germany, the article mentions, and now a pretty significant investment in the Brazilian market. And they mentioned that it's not just the money that's the big deal, it's the strategy. And Nubank wants to get a lot of the expertise in services and financial payments that Tencent has. So.
Yeah, I think that they also see the fact that all the bad companies have basically inserted themselves into the financial system in China now, and they can offer things from online marketplaces and credit cards and payment stuff as part of an ecosystem. And I think that they see Brazil as also maybe potentially following the same path as well. I think that ecosystems going forward will definitely rule the roost. But yeah, this is basically a way for Tencent to again kind of expand into more. South to south market, and seems like a pretty interesting play to expand their ecosystems beyond Asia. So we haven't seen a lot of investments recently in Latin America, but I'm gladdened to see that it's taking place now. And I also like the fact that it's again sort of that south south model. It's not US companies or European companies investing in the hemisphere, but it's other companies from across the globe as well, who maybe have the expertise to work in non-traditional and underserved markets.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they mentioned that the central bank in Brazil is looking at the possibility of instant payments, and in reference to your last article, they're also looking at India's experiment with demonetization. So it seems like the ideas are getting passed around, and this might be the model that works.
Right. That this could be the future here.
So speaking of different markets, there's an interesting article about Islamic finance and how fintech is really growing in that area to serve the very specific needs of Sharia compliant finance. And that's a pretty large market. In 2016, it's estimated that there was $2.2 trillion in Sharia compliant financial assets, and that's expected to grow to $3.8 trillion by 2022. And that's across 1,400 Islamic financial institutions operating in about 80 countries. And fintech brings a lot of solutions to issues that people have had, especially with trust and security, and in underdeveloped markets, things like identity, which is one of the big applications being developed for, you know, on blockchain and key for a lot of fintech uses, applications. So things like eye scans, fingerprints, facial recognition can be a digital identity for people who are unbanked or undocumented. And they can use a digital wallet in order to, you know, have their financial assets all embedded in a blockchain. And kind of like what we've seen with underdeveloped countries skipping ahead, mm-hmm. kind of like China skipping landlines and everybody just has a cell phone as their first phone before countries like the United States. And so we see this in the Islamic world. So some of the applications that address this kind of trust issue and making sure that something is Sharia compliant addresses a real concern. In a survey, 34% of Afghan adults cited religious reasons for not having a bank account, and this was about 27% for Iraqis and Tunisians.
So can I ask you, what makes a fintech product or solution Sharia compliant?
Oh, so they can, well, it's a lot of the services going into it. So they can build in that programming into their system so that it meets all the rules and it's transparent. So they can go and look through the code or the contracts online and see that, you know, how it's being, how they're addressing Sharia compliance.
I thought the whole thing.
So unlike, you know, you might go to a bank and you don't know what they're doing and they could just say they're doing, you know, they're compliant when maybe they'll make exceptions or they'll do something else. In this case, it's that transparency that gives that confidence in the product.
I assume that a lot of the issues driving Sharia law are the companies have to invest in some industries and another. So I know that, for example, Sharia compliant banks cannot invest in things like alcohol or pornography or weapons.
Sure. Yeah. Yes, exactly. So that's one thing that has to be monitored closely. And that transparency, again, on the blockchain gives that confidence that they are being compliant and they can rest easy that their religious concerns are being addressed. There's actually a Sharia-compliant cryptocurrency that's being developed by a company called OneGram. And also there's a New York-based company called Wahed Invest, which launched a Sharia-compliant robo-advisor. And just recently, Stellar, the cryptocurrency, received certification from Islamic scholars for its blockchain platform and cryptocurrency.
So people who want to be Sharia compliant can now see via the blockchain whether their investments or the vehicles they're investing in or whatever they're engaged in meets the Sharia compliance requirements.
Yeah, exactly. So RegTech is being used to minimize the potential for some kind of breach of the Sharia compliance. And then at the same time, you can have new products. So it kind of helps with some of the restrictions and compliance by being flexible, by having the coding, using things like data mining that can better serve the customers, addressing, like we said, identity issues to bank more customers in places where this is a concern. And so it's a large market. It has a lot of potential, and it's currently still not as developed. So there's room for companies to grow when they're providing these kinds of services. So as of December 2017, this article mentions that there were 116 fintech companies offering Sharia compliant products, and 14 of these were in the United States, and these mainly focus on payments, remittances, you know, international payments, as you would expect, and mm-hmm. crowdfunding. So one of these fintech companies is a market exchange called Hulk, H-U-U-L-K, which is a digital exchange that's Sharia compliant, And it's working with European exchanges to open up the market. And it's really focused around Islamic fintech firms, which operate in Muslim-majority countries like Turkey and Malaysia, which is another application and shows how much market growth can be for Islamic finance.
It also seems like a space that's ripe for leveraging mobile technology, because a lot of the Muslim-majority countries in the Middle East and in Asia, like in Indonesia and Malaysia, have very, very high mobile penetration rates. And I can see how this could tie into sort of having Sharia-compliant Islamic finance solutions that are mostly mobile as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It really lends itself to this kind of solution. So, you know, very interesting. A different kind of market, and one that is growing very quickly. And now into robo-advisors who are eating into financial advisor fees. Mutual funds, index funds, these fees have been dropping for a while now. Trading is more or less free or very, very cheap. And hedge funds have even started to drop their usually very high fees and charges. Financial advisors have seemed like they've been more or less immune to this price decline. But now we've finally starting to see these prices get hit. Vanguard Group has now introduced a robo-advisor that only charges 0.3% of assets annually. And Charles Schwab has an offering that has zero management fees. Now, just to give you a point of comparison, usually these advisors and human advisors charge between 1 and 1.5% of their assets annually. And this is according to a research firm called Cerulli Associates. So that that 1 to 1.5% can be huge amounts of advisor fees. This 1 to 1.5% can be huge on hundreds of billion dollars of assets that are being invested.
So I wonder, is this because these sort of incumbents, the Vanguards and Schwabs of the world, have seen a lot of their customers flee away from their platforms towards Betterment or Sigfig or Wealthfront? And
yeah, it's definitely a response to the competition. In fact, there's one company that's that has individual advisors that usually charge 1.5%, and a lot of them are starting to go down to 0.9%, which is still higher than a lot of the robo-advisors, but you're still getting a human touch around that. But they're doing it on their own in order to keep up with the competition. So they must be hearing about these new fintech you know, robo-advisors that are eating into their business.
It makes sense. I know that many of the incumbent players, again, the Vanguards and the Schwabs of the world, have much, much higher assets under management than, you know, the newer fintech players. But there seems to be a model now where they are going to hybridize and make it, you can get some robo-advisor on the side, but also if you do want to talk to a human, we also have that option. That
like an extra premium.
Exactly. For like a slightly higher fee, you can have, in addition to a really cool-looking app on your phone or like really good information into your performance to the minute, you can now also go to a financial advisor and get actual one-on-one human advice, which seems to me like a differentiator between these new players and what the incumbents are doing.
Well, you're right. And the first part you were saying, it's still a very small part of the market. The robo-advice industry is estimated to be around $200 billion in assets as of the end of 2017. And that compares to $20.3
trillion. $1 trillion of the T.
In the overall brokerage investments. So still a very small part of the pie. Growing pretty quickly. That $200 billion was $80 billion more than it was a year ago. So if they keep up these growth rates, it'll start to eat in more significantly. But they're already trying to head off these companies at the pass. So these large brokerage companies with these trillions of dollars of investment assets that they don't want to lose, even if it is only a few hundred billion, are starting to offer a next level down of service, mainly serviced by robo-advising, that they can offer at a cheaper price.
I wonder how their performance actually compares. So I have some pocket change in a Wealthfront account, but I wonder if I had put the same money with the same risk levels in a Vanguard account, would I be better off now? Is there a difference between Because it's mostly ETFs.
I don't know about your investment. Maybe you could check to see what that Vanguard would have invested in and kind of done a side-by-side.
That's a pretty fun weekend overall, project.
Overall, I don't know if you know, definitely the advising cost of 1 and 1.5% can eat into your returns.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, over 10 years, that's a pretty significant chunk of your investment. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, and especially with hedge funds, we've seen that kind of backlash against these kind of, in their case, more outrageous fees as people clamor to invest with successful investors.
2 and 20, right?
2 and 20, yeah. I think that's finally starting to get eaten into. Very deservedly so, because pretty hefty fees. So the way that the incumbents have to compete is by offering more service. They do things like your taxes. They offer business advice. They prepare you for retirement and transition, kind of like psychological and family advisors for this millennial group, which is inheriting, it's going to be the generation that inherits the most money ever, I think.
The biggest wealth transfer in human history.
Yeah. So advising them on and kind of like those overall issues, they're very high touch. I mean, this is a very specific service that you have to have a person for. You can have them help you plan for your child's education. So these kinds of things you can't get with a robo-advisor. And maybe it's worth it to pay a little bit more. But still, at least robo-advisors are keeping their prices competitive. So it's good for everyone, I think.
Sounds like a pretty good use case for the way that technology can bring down prices.
And now it's time for our final bite, where we take a look at a number and the story behind it. I'll start with 16.
That's a very tiny number.
That's a small number, but for a very representing a large, large amount. These are the number of cryptocurrencies that have a market cap greater than $1 billion. That's right. There's 16 cryptocurrencies that have over $1 billion in market cap. And the smallest one is $1.14 billion.
Just over that threshold there.
Just over, yeah. And that's for Ethereum Classic. So I think, I guess some people are still holding on and hoping that that'll be the big winner someday, but probably not. And of course, the largest is Bitcoin, which as of October 10th at 1:20 Pacific Daylight Time, had a market cap of $114.2 billion, which is, of course, about a third of its peak back in December of 2017. In second place is Ethereum with $23 billion and XRP, the Ripple cryptocurrency, at $18 billion, which occasionally pops over the Ethereum market cap, but is now dropped below a little bit. So we still have a lot of money in cryptocurrencies. So I hope you haven't lost it all yet.
Hodl. Keep hodling.
Yeah. All right.
That's a good number. Thank you. My final bite is actually a little bit larger. It's $1.1 billion.
Oh, you got me beat.
I know. So, John, have you seen on the streets of San Francisco these billboards and bus stop signs for this company called Brex?
Oh, those black ones.
The black ones, right, with the stripe, the diagonal. So Brex is the corporate card aimed at startups. And at their newest valuation, which I think is based on the latest funding round, that they had a Series C funding from DSC Global last week or so, they're now valued at $1.1 billion. Brex is a company that basically is selling shovels. They offered credit card solutions and other sort of payment things for startups in the Bay Area, but also across the globe.
Right.
Yeah, these two students, who one of whom came to the U.S. from Brazil to study at Stanford, or both actually came to the U.S., dropped out and then formed this company to provide services to startups. And it sounds like it's just kind of like a beefed up Amex card, like a corporate card. But I'm guessing they have other ways to make it cool and interesting. But
so teenagers from Brazil come to America and become almost billionaires.
Almost billionaires, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
By selling credit cards to their fellow Y Combinator.
I hope their visa is still valid.
I think they get around that rule by, I think if you invest a certain amount in the U.S., you can get a permanent residency.
Yeah, I think it's 500,000, and I don't think they're that on that program, but yeah.
Yeah, but anyway, kind of interesting that, yeah, it took him all of 20 or so months to go from zero to $1.1 billion.
Yeah, right. They came here with just a little bit of money. I guess they had some a company in Brazil that was related to payments, so they didn't just come out of it in the cold. I mean, they had a few teenage years to develop this expertise. So very interesting. Great to see a rags to riches success story on talent and coming to the U.S. I know that they saw Silicon Valley as, you know, the dream of every tech developer and for growing your business. So that's great to see. So that's it for this week's episode of the FinTech Newscast. If you have any questions or comments or would like to see us discuss a specific topic, please feel free to email us at info@fintechnewscast.com. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in FinTech news. And thank you for listening.
Bye for now.